Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Too much, too furious. It took place on Sunday. This time, instead of only having Phil and Tiger breathing heavily into mics like the last time, they added a little twist. And that twist was a pair of anonymous unknowns by the name of Peyton Manning and Tom Brady. Let me start with the good news because that's pretty much how I am. Start with positive news. Positive news is it raised a hell of a lot of money. $20 million, in fact, for coronavirus relief efforts, which is awesome. In fact, it's incredible. And it's good to see something that could roughly be referred to as a live sport. That's good too, right? But let's be real about this. I know we're all pretty desperate for live sports, something to see, something to do, something to talk about. But let's go ahead and stop acting like that was something awesome. Can we stop acting like that was something awesome? I mean, did we all watch the same thing? I don't think we did, because that was not nearly as awesome as some folks would have you believe it was. Because the way some folks were acting, we just saw the most riveting sporting event ever. And without question, one of the most hilarious things ever put on the small screen. Again, what were some of you watching? It was neither of those things. What it was better than the match part one and made a hell of a lot of money for a really good cause. So that's good. But exactly what were you watching? What was so hilarious and awesome about that? Why don't we start with Tiger showing up wearing cargo shorts? Yes, cargo shorts. Do not argue with me. I don't care if that was some kind of modern spin on cargo shorts. They were cargo shorts. And that set the stage for what was about to become one of the corniest sporting events ever. And not just corny, corny as hell.
Just corny.
Not just corny, corny as hell. You knew the golf from Manning and Brady was not going to be especially good, but the comedy wasn't any better. Check out, for instance, this hilarious zinger, and not at all manufactured, from Manning on the range when he was asked about who he would have as his caddy.
And my partner, Brady, we were talking, he would have brought Gronkowski because Gronk does whatever Tom asks him to do. Gronk will wrestle, take a year off, come play in Tampa with me later, come caddy for me. You know, it's hard to get to him, right? But, you know, do you bring Eli? Could do that. You bring Nick Foles? Maybe.
Cheap shot.
Boom! Holy crap! Roasted! He'd bring, if you can hear it through that terrible audio, he'd bring Nick Foles or Eli. Have some, Brady. How'd that taste? You know, the two guys who beat you in a Super Bowl? Dang! Yeah, that felt really natural. Not at all rehearsed. Not at all pre-written. How does Pinky not chase that by going upside TB43's head with a cut that meat taunt?
Cut that meat!
And if he was going to bring Eli into this, why not make Brady officiate another Oreo lick race between the Manning bros? I mean, what's more intimidating than those two dudes furiously licking Oreos? No way Brady sees that and is able to focus for the next shot. Yeah, I said it. That's what they did. That was some campaign, wasn't it? The Oreo lick race. Brilliant. At the very least, Manning should have rolled his boy Papa John out there to carry the bag for a few holes and to set the record straight on Tommy's nonsense about eating avocado ice cream. After all, the Papa does smash more than a pie a day.
40 pizzas in 30 days.
But you knew Tom Brady was not going to take all that lying down. This dude went from being a sixth rounder with seemingly no athletic ability to the best to ever do it. So you knew he was going to have some napalm on his own, and he did. Check out this clap back on Manning.
He's hitting it pretty good in the rain. I'm impressed. He's more of a dome quarterback, so maybe he's the inclement weather. He can actually hang in there today. So. Trey, maybe bunt it down the fairway a little bit. I was saying earlier, these are the types of days where you want to hand the ball off.
Correct.
You don't want to do too much throwing today, but just scrape it around. Should be a good day.
Dude, did he just call him a dome quarterback? Holy crap. He went there. I mean, damn, is this a charity golf event or a rap battle? These two dudes are killing each other. But Brady knew that was too harsh. He knew it was too harsh to go with that dome quarterback blast, so he softened it up by pointing out in these weather conditions, you just want to hand the ball off. You know, because they're quarterbacks and it's raining. Damn, these two dudes are amazing. They're great at football, and they're even better at comedy and talking smack. Is there anything these two legends can't do? Well, golf, for one. Because after that weather delay, the first tee went about as well as you might expect. Manning shanked one into the palmetto bushes, had to take a drop. Brady was not much better. In fact, the biggest news from the front nine is that Tom Brady really is not that good at golf. And by not that good at golf, I mean he's pretty much a genuine hack. It almost looked like this dude had never picked up a club before in his life. And then on the third tee, he sliced one and opened up the door for the roast master general, Tiger Woods, to come in with the serious heat.
That could be fairway.
Over on seven.
By the way, you got to really pay attention when Tiger's throwing the jabs. Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
That'll be in the fairway. Over on seven.
Yeah, we heard that. We all got it. That'll be in the fairway. Over on seven. Hey-o! That's the famous Tiger sense of humor that everybody talks about that we never get to see. And my man was letting it rip on Sunday. And there was Brady, back in trouble, off the tee on five.
Oh, gotta go. Down. That's good. Down.
Oh. Splash down.
Agua.
TB12. Struggling.
TB43, struggling in the agua. Yeah, he was struggling with the clubs, but was not struggling with the comedy. Check out this fire exchange. Be or about Manning's Tennessee mascot head cover and how it just turns into an all-out war about their alma maters.
I mean, who else is it on? It's not on Phil's.
Oh.
That's not the Arizona State mascot.
No.
Don't.
I missed that tee. Hold on. Let me step on that real quick.
Let me put in Michigan.
They haven't been good since you left. Can you help recruit them a little? Recruit some quarterbacks or something?
Barkley and Thomas are in trouble.
Struggling. Man, this is so cringy. It is so corny and so cringy. And then in the blindest luck in the history of blind luck, Brady somehow managed to do this.
Come on, man. I'm going to give you some shots, man. I want all some right. of you.
Got it turned on. Don't worry. It ain't over yet.
Go in!
Yeah! Oh, my goodness!
Oh, you made it!
Wow!
Oh. Take a second at Chuck.
Wow.
Hey.
Chuck.
Hey, man.
Chuck.
That's
Chuck.
Awesome.
Shut your mouth, Chuck.
Unreal.
Take a little of that medicine. Get your butt out of here.
Hey.
Wow.
That's what I needed.
Sausage hey. Back in the hole.
Hey, way to get $100,000 for Brooks Koepka.
What a
thanks,
tasty
baby.
Mortal.
Brooks, take
wow.
Brooks, how about that?
Hey. Let me tell you what that was, and let me tell you what that was not. That was an amazing shot. I'll leave it at that. An amazing shot, but let me tell you what that was not. That was not some sign that Tom Brady is the ultimate competitor and that you can never count him out, and he proved it yet again as to why he's the GOAT. He didn't. He holed an amazing shot, and then he promptly busted his pants. Literally. But man, he was feeling it after that hole out, because then he brought the fire after this missed putt on eight.
That's good.
Thanks.
Right. Three for two.
So three Thanks. For two it is.
So, partner, it's going to...
Eli would have made that one.
It's going to be right. Fractionally left, and when it gets here, it's going to be fractionally...
Man, dang, he did it. He went there. He just did Peyton like that. And then if a joke is a good one once, you know what the pros do. They're going to use it again.
Manning.
He's not wasting any time.
Yep, for the half.
Ooh.
Unforced error.
That's a gift.
Okay.
You would have made that one.
It is a gentleman's game, isn't it?
You hear that? Quote, Eli definitely would have made that one. Like, he went there again. Shut it down. Let's go home.
Shut it down. Let's go home.
And there was more where that came from. In fact, all that great smack turned out to be contagious. How about this omnipotent blast from Phil after Brady hit a big putt?
Off of Phil's drive here.
Do it. Do it. A two. A two.
Oh!
Yes, because that's how we roll.
All right, that's the winner.
That's good, Tiger. Pick that one up.
He's back in the game, Trevor. This is a great putt.
I'm telling you, man, I can keep this going. I could keep going because there is so much more of this. Just one cringy, corny moment after another. The kind of thing that we're all going to look back on at some point and think, man, do you remember how hard up we were during the pandemic for sports of any kind? So hard up. So hard up that we were actually betting the weather. So hard up that we actually thought the match two was funny or cool. Let me say this, though. There was a breakout star from that event. A breakout star from the event who gets his own take. I mean, a legitimate star. And he will get his own take a little bit later on. As for the event overall, I'm really glad that it raised all that money for coronavirus relief. And I will say, the match two was better than the match one because I'm not sure anything could have been any worse. And yes, I will give you this. The back nine was certainly better than the front nine on Sunday. But let's go ahead and not act like this was the single greatest event in the history of television because it was not that. I know it's been a long, long time since we've had anything to watch, but we are not so desperate that seeing these guys qualifies as great comedy or great golf. It was neither. Yes, Phil was bombing tee shots, getting really amped, talking a bunch. Tiger did look a hell of a lot better than the last time we saw him. But golfing with Phil and these two jesters for 18 holes in carts is totally different from four rounds of serious competition. I'm glad the whole thing happened. I'm even more glad it's over because it was corny as hell. It raised a lot of money. That's good. It raised a lot of money and it raised even more corn.
Because that's how we roll.
Because that's how we roll.
That's good, Tiger. Pick that one up.
Pick that up, Cat. I mean, dudes, really? Corny and cringy.
Maybe fairway. Over on seven.
Oh! The Roastmaster. Capital One knows life does not alert you about your credit card. Hey, couch surfers. We've got nonstop tunes to keep you rocking while you work. Oh, and Colleen. Yes, you, Colleen with a K. Your free trial of Movie Plus ends tomorrow, and your card may be charged. Do you want to continue or do you want to cancel? Sweet. So, meet Eno, the Capital One assistant. Eno looks out for surprise charges, like when free trials expire, and helps you if you need to fix them. Eno, another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you are not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Limitations apply. We are joined by Martin Jarman. Martin, it is so good to have you on the program. Before we get into your new opportunity, I want to ask you, how are you, your wife, and your daughters doing during this unusual time in this pandemic?
We're hanging in there, Jim, and I appreciate you having me in the jungle. Long-time listener, so this is an honor to be with you.
That's great to hear. I appreciate you saying that, Martin. It's great to have you on the program. I was looking forward to it. Listen, when you consider the history of UCLA athletics and the position that UCLA holds in NCAA history and cultural history, what does it feel like then to hear yourself introduced as the athletic director at UCLA? Does that even feel real to you?
Goosebumps. You know, it's an honor. It still hasn't hit me yet, just the level of success, 118 championships, second most in the country, just the leaders and the people that have come through those doors at UCLA. I just pinch myself. It's unbelievable to have this opportunity to lead and serve.
Martin Jarman is joining us. He's the new AD at UCLA. Now, you had a really good thing going at Boston College. There was success among the teams. You were overall eighth in the nation in graduation success rate. So what was it then about the opportunity at UCLA that made it feel like it was just too good to pass up?
Yeah, it was tough to leave Boston College. The energy and momentum we had over the 3 years was phenomenal, and we made some great strides. But when UCLA is comes open and available, it's one of those opportunities you just can't pass up. I mean, to be a part of something as special as UCLA and the history all across the board, broad-based excellence, you know, it's one of those moments where you have to look at yourself and say, do I have the ability and the opportunity to do this? You got to do it. And that's what UCLA is.
And at the same time, it's really tricky to make a move like that during a pandemic. As an example, for those who do not know, how much time have you spent on the UCLA campus to this point?
I have never been on campus. So my first time will be when I move.
That really is something. But again, because we're in really unusual times, it's understandable. You know, it's such a difficult decision to leave Boston College. You were pretty emotional about that, understandably. So as you look back on your time there, what kind of memories do you have?
Oh, just the successes of our student athletes, the moments that we had. There've been so many. I can't name one, but it was fun. You know, Boston College gave me an opportunity. It was my first athletic director position, and they embraced me. And you know, it was a great ride, a great journey. It was really tough to leave. Very emotional. You know, I cried more in the last couple of days than I have in the last 20 years. And that's because of the people at Boston College and just how great a place it is. So. It was really tough, really emotional for me, but I'm looking forward to UCLA and getting started and keeping on the tradition of being elite.
Martin Jarman's joining us. He is the AD at UCLA. Now, you played your college basketball at UNC Wilmington. You were a two-time captain there. You led the tournament or team to the NCAA tournament for the first time in school history. What about that experience? As you look back on that, what do you remember most?
I remember the community. You know, that was the first time that UNC Wilmington had made the NCAA tournament in school history. And for those kind of leagues, the CAA, it's a one-bid league. So to do something like that, especially the first time ever, it's just special. So I remember just the community embracing us. I remember that first-round game. I think we were a 15 seed against a 2 seed Cincinnati. I don't remember much about the game. It wasn't close. But just to have that experience of being the first and doing something special with my teammates, unreal.
You know, you've had some really good opportunities, and you've been around some really unique people. I know for a fact that Ohio State AD Gene Smith has had an enormous impact on you as well. What did you take from your time with him?
Whew, what didn't I take from Gene? You know, he's the best in the business. Just being around him for 8 years, you hope that some of his skills and talents rub off and you get some of it and soak it in. But just his humanistic approach, he cares about people. He's humanistic in all his decisions that he does. He's comfortable in his own skin. You know, he's going to be who he is, and he's very transparent and straight up. And that's the way that I try to be. And, you know, so there's no guessing. But he's the best. I mean, he's a giant, and I'm just fortunate I was able to work with him for 8 years.
Martin Jarman's joining us. UCLA's got a new AD. You know, this is interesting to me. A.J. Dillon is a running back at Boston College. He said this about you, quote, "He was more than just an athletic advisor. He allowed us to have a voice about all things. We could go in there and talk to him. I feel like that's not everywhere," end quote. I would agree with that. I don't think that is everywhere. So where did that approach come from, and why is that important to you?
You know, you got to meet people where they are, and we serve student athletes. And so just like A.J., meeting with him, the first time I messaged with him, he DM'd me on Twitter, you know, and so I think you got to connect with young people. And so you can't lose track of that, lose sight of that. So I think that's where that engagement and hopefully my age and just doing this communication wise, you got to be on social and you got to interact and engage and make people feel comfortable. And I'm just so pleased that the AJ felt comfortable enough to me to establish a relationship. And it's been great to see him get drafted second round, and now I'm going to be a big Packers fan rooting for him.
And then, of course, part of that gig is communicating and connecting with the coaches, too. I know you've already spoken with Chip Kelly. What was that conversation like?
It was great. You know, Chip is straight up. You don't have to guess. And so I appreciated it. We talked for about a half hour, and we didn't even talk about football that much, just getting to know each other. So it was great. I look forward to working with him and just learning from him as how much I can help the program and what I can do to help them be successful. But, you know, obviously he's done a lot in his career, and I'm excited to work with a guy like Chip.
You know, Martin, obviously you're coming into a situation where you've got college sports and everything around it being affected by COVID-19, and it's going to impact the university. It's going to impact the athletic departments. How are you approaching all of that?
You know, you have to, this kind of situation, no one's been through it. So you have to be very mindful of listening to the experts, listening to everybody else. You know, we like to be in control, and this is one of those where we're not in control. So I like to lean on the medical experts. Most important is the health and safety of our young people and our fans. And so, you know, I just lean in and really try to learn and listen to the experts that know a lot better than me what's appropriate, what's safe, and then we'll move forward that way.
Now, you've talked in the past about how you believe that your goals should be scary. You did that at BC. What kind of scary goals do you have at UCLA?
Well, elite. UCLA is elite. And it's our job, coaches, staff, administrators, to maintain being elite and even take it to the next level. in all of our sports. So, you know, my job is really to look at things, how we evaluate, listen and learn, and then put a plan together to maintain UCLA being elite. That's what college athletics deserves, UCLA to be elite. That's what our fans deserve, and that's what we're going to be.
All right, so before you go, I want to ask you about one more topic. If it were only about COVID-19, that would be a big enough challenge, but there's more. There are also the issues that relate to student-athletes being able to receive compensation for their name, their image, their likeness. I know you haven't even moved in yet, but these are issues that you faced at BC as well. So how do you go about approaching that particular issue?
Yeah, you know, it's still being tweaked right now in legislation, and I'm sure it'll be voted on in January. But, you know, I look at name, image, and likeness as an opportunity. We're in the education business. Our job is to educate young people. So to me, what better way to educate them on their brand, on their opportunities with name, image, and likeness? Obviously, we got to make sure that it fits the right way and make sure that our students and teams and schools are able to utilize it properly. But, you know, I think it's an educational tool, and that's what we're supposed to do. So I look forward to leaning in on name, image, and likeness and really helping our young people understand their brand and value and business. That's all things they're going to have to do when they graduate from college anyhow. So why not help them during that process while they're in school?
So then if you had to guess, how different might college athletics look in a few years?
It has the potential to look very different. But, you know, again, we've had different challenges, different opportunities throughout college athletics in the history, and by and large, it still remained the same. Giving young people the chance at an opportunity to education, it hasn't changed a whole lot. I don't imagine it'll change a ton. It could, but, you know, I just worry about what's next and the next day and just do the work.
It's an amazing university, to be sure. Great athletic department, too. He is the new director of athletics at UCLA. He was named AD last week, just the 9th athletic director in school history, and served in that same capacity at Boston College for the previous 3 years. Martin, great to have you here in Southern California. Great to hear that you're a Jungle listener, and I will look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much for doing it.
I'm looking forward to the smack-off on June 19th, Jim.
Dude, I love that. My man, Drizzle. Long time no talk. What's up, man? How are you?
Yo, what's up with Jerome? Jerome, how you living today,
good,
baby?
Good, dude. How about you? I got a better question. How are you living?
Yo, man, I can't complain. You know what I'm sizzling. But first thing I want to do, Rome, is I haven't had the opportunity yet. I just want to say congratulations on the Hall of Fame. Well-deserved. Been in radio a long time. I've been listening to myself since about 96, man. So to see you still doing your thing, it's all gravity, baby, as far as I'm concerned. Can
I
you
appreciate
dig
that? Yeah, man, thank you very much. I appreciate you saying that.
It's all lovely, baby. So look, man, I'm just going to spill all the tea right now, man. So I need everybody to pay attention. In 2018, the very beginning, everything was lovely. And it all came to a crashing halt when literally in a 7-month period, I lost my grandmother, my 18-year-old brother, my aunt, my father, and a career that I worked very hard to attain, all within that 7-month span. Through another series of unfortunate events back in 2019, starting in September, when I started calling the show, I was homeless, sleeping in my car, sleeping in shelters. I was sitting in my old man's driveway. He was a huge fan. He was the one who got me started listening. We were from the days of the Rat Pack, you know what I'm saying? So I was like, you know what? To hell with it, man. I'm going to call Roman just see what happened, man. It was really an ode to my pop more than anything. Now, I didn't know things were going to turn into what they did, but ultimately, man, I had to reshift my focus. Can you dig that? So I started working 3 jobs, got everything on level. Now I got my own spot, but I work hard, and I can't afford to lose nothing. Now, Rome, I understand doing what you got to do, baby. You know what I'm sizzling? Because I'm not about to be like Conor McGregor and hold up a division just so that way somebody else will get slided. That ain't how I roll. But I got my priorities straight, and I got everything good. And I know a lot of people think that maybe Uncle Fester, a.k.a. Matt in L.A., ran me off, but that's just not how it went down. I did my thing. I stayed sizzling. Shout out to 12 Wood. Can you dig that? Rome, man, I appreciate the opportunity and the platform to say what's really good with it. Stay doing your thing. Again, congratulations on the Hall. For the last time, maybe, what's my name out?
My man. Let's go to Los Angeles. Matt in L.A. What's going on, Matt?
Tell me, buenos dias, Van Smack. From Irvine to the Ivory Coast. From Newport to Nigeria. You're welcome. But first things first. I heard Fizzy Bobo, Fizzle finally got his Metro PCS cell phone line back on for long enough to call in and get his golden ticket back. What a surprise. I mean, to old Fizzy Bobo, that five grr is about $5 million. I mean, he's going to be able to secure his one-bedroom rental for the next decade if he could come in here and represent. But we all know that ain't going to happen. Hey, Drizzle, you know, you had plenty of time to come in here and run smack. And the first thing that you wanted to do was mention my name, your boy Matt in L.A., and try to claim that I didn't run you off. When we all can go back to the Stuckner files and see I did run your bum ass off. But I don't need to resort to bum smack, homie. I will just bitch smack you like I do all the competitors. That's all I got, Jimmy. War, Griffey the astronaut cat, and myself going on a long cruise after I win the smack off. How true.
Matt in L.A., though. Lance, the two-part series on Lance Armstrong debuted on Sunday night, and man, that thing got off to a riveting start, didn't it?
When my life took the turn that it took, I said to myself, everywhere that I go for the rest of my life, somebody is going to walk up to me and say, f*** you. And so a couple days go by, and nobody said, f*** you. And then months go by, and years go by, and I'm like, I always know when somebody wants to say, f*** you, but nobody does. Nobody ever does. So it took 5 years. I was staying in this rental house, calling Uber. And he pulls up on the other side of the street, right in front of the bar. We cross the street, and this guy stands up, and he says, hey, Lance. And I'm like, what's up, man? And he goes, f*** you. F*** you. F*** you. F*** you. And the next thing you know, he's with like 6 or 7 people. They all stand up and start going, f*** you, f*** you, f*** you, you f***ing cheater, f*** you.
Pretty fascinating story, right? Well, it's not the story that's fascinating, but the way he starts the story that's fascinating. Quote, when my life took the turn that it took. That kind of set the entire tone, didn't it? When my life took the turn that it took. Check out the passive voice on that one. I love how he's referring to being a cheater and an international disgrace as a, quote, turn that his life just happened to take. Like he was just a passenger and had absolutely nothing to do with it. Like he was just out on a bike ride and suddenly the bike by itself veered in a different direction and he had no way of changing that. It's an interesting insight into how he views life because despite the fact that he says he always asked about what drugs he was taking, he always knew what drugs he was taking, and always made the decision to take them on his own. You know, there was none of that I've never knowingly, well, after he denied it for years. But in the end, I knew what I was doing, I knew what I was taking, I made that decision. There's that, but he still likes to portray himself as the victim, and he's still pissed. And he says at one point, some people just can't chill the bleep out. Lance Armstrong said that about others. Some people can't chill the bleep out. Dude, that's you. You're the one who can't chill the bleep out. The rest of us have all moved on. And that's the other weird thing about that documentary. It's not new. There's not a lot of news that's there that we didn't already know. There's not a lot of information there that we didn't already know. What's new about that? I mean, there is a lot of time spent on his childhood, his mom, his stepfather, Terry Armstrong, who seems like a real piece of work, to the point that Lance thought about changing his name back to his birth father's last name.
I would always think about changing my name back to, I guess, my biological name, but I never even began to start that process, so it couldn't have been that serious. And then when at some point, it's too late, you know, because by the age of 15, you know, I was already establishing myself and my career and a brand or whatever that means. And so then it was too late. Plus it's a good name. I like the name. Lance Armstrong. I think that's a good name. It's better than Lance Gunderson. That's a kind of a weird name.
It's kind of an interesting detail, sort of. Except I'm not really sure why it exists now. Kind of like the whole documentary as a whole. Like, what's the point? Is it just a recap of Lance's life and his career? Because we already know a lot about that. We know how he was an amazing cyclist early in his career, then plateaued, then was diagnosed with testicular cancer, which spread to his brain, and then he came back to win 7 straight Tour de France titles. It's one of the most amazing stories of all time. Or it was, until it was confirmed that he had been cheating and that he was not the man at the center of the most amazing and inspiring story of all time. He was, to quote USADA, a, quote, serial cheater who led, quote, the most sophisticated, professionalized, and successful doping program the sport has ever seen, end quote. And he doesn't really seem to have changed all that much since then. So again, the question, why are we doing a documentary about him right now? And why this documentary? As an example, it doesn't feature Jeff Nowitzki. He was the one who played a major role in bringing down Lance. He told Greg Rosenstein he would not participate in the documentary, quote, not interested if Lance is playing a role in it, end quote. That makes sense, because given Lance's history, you might think that this is some sort of image rehab project for Lance. Again, why are they doing this? Why now? It's got to be an image rehab project, right? Well, if that's what he was hoping for, that's failing horribly. It's hard to come away from watching that doc and having some great sense of sympathy for Lance. He's just not coming off as a really likable guy. In fact, it's quite the opposite. He does not come across like a guy who's sorry for what he did. He's coming off like somebody, of course, who's sorry he got caught. And sorry that the rest of us just don't get it. Like, he's pissed that you're pissed at him for cheating. And the weird thing is, I'm not even sure how many people are still pissed at him. I don't know how many people are still thinking about him and talking about him. Like, everybody moved on, right? He's had numerous times to come clean and truly own what he did and the people he let down, but he's either not really interested in doing that, or he can't, or he just won't. Just when you think there's a chance that he might own it, just when you think he might be aware of the damage that he's done because so many people believed in him and his story, then he turns around and he does this.
The last 5 years has really caused me to pause and try to understand not just myself, but what this story meant to other people, what this story meant to the world, right? And, that's a heavy thing to think about. I never knew the story was as big as it was. I knew it was big, but I didn't know it was that big. If I was competing today, I could tell you who my peers would be, right? My peers would be Michael Phelps, LeBron James. And so I see where they are. And so only now do I realize, okay, that's where you were. That's where I was.
Like, wait, what? Like, I thought he was going to go there. I thought he was going to get to that point where he did own it. But then he mentions Michael Phelps. He pivots Michael Phelps, LeBron James. Like, are you kidding me? The difference between you and them is that they aren't, quote, serial cheaters. To the best of our knowledge, they aren't running incredibly sophisticated doping programs. And how about him saying that if he had stayed at that level, it would not have been good for his family? My man, the reason you're not at that level and held in that regard has got nothing to do with your family. It's all about you and your cheating. If you didn't cheat, if you did everything you did cleanly, you would still be that legend today because you were an inspiration to millions. Like, the story he told was of a guy who beat cancer and then beat everybody in the toughest, most grueling sport ever. And he did it clean and he did it the right way. That was the story that we all bought, most of us. That was the story that raised millions and millions of dollars for cancer, for research and awareness. That was the story that inspired millions of people in their battles. Except it wasn't true. He didn't do it clean. He didn't do it the right way. And it doesn't matter that every other rider was on something either, because those who support him will come in and say that. Yeah, well, everybody else was. Maybe. But Lance was the one telling everybody that he was not on anything other than his bike. Remember this spot?
This is my body. And I can do whatever I want to it. I can push it, study it, tweak it, listen to it. Everybody wants to know what I'm on. What am I on? I'm on my bike, busting my ass 6 hours a day. What are you on?
Is that incredible when you think back on that? Given what he was doing? I mean, he was telling you that he was doing it clean. He said it point blank. He was telling you he was on his bike 6 hours a day, busting his ass. Yet was doping like crazy. And by the way, this is something. How about this part of the story? Did the doping play a role in his cancer diagnosis?
Do you think you got cancer because of the doping?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. And I don't want to say no because I don't think that's right either. I don't know if it's yes or no, but I certainly wouldn't say no. The only thing I will tell you is the only time in my life that I ever did growth hormone was the 1996 season. And so just in my head, I'm like, growth, like growing hormones and cells, like if anything good needs to be grown, it does. But wouldn't it make also sense that if anything bad is there, that it too would grow?
Blurted out. Remember that time that Chael Sonnen just blurted it out? Lance Armstrong gave himself cancer. And man, we were all like, dude, you didn't really just say that, did you? And then you hear Lance in that doc saying, I don't know, maybe. Then there's the question of whether or not it was hard to go back to EPO.
After you faced death, was it hard to take EPO?
You mean the decision? Because we did EPO before and then obviously did it after. No. No.
Does that sound like somebody who's overly bothered by his cheating? I would say no. No. You know, it brings up an aspect that's always tricky because so many of us, myself included, bought in, right? When you look back now, it's so obvious that he was cheating. He was competing in a sport where almost everybody, I don't know exactly what the number is, but there was prevalent cheating. Lots of cheating. And guys are doping and cheating out their asses. And yet he comes back from death to not just compete, but to dominate year in and year out for 7 straight years. I mean, of course, it's very easy to say right now, of course he was cheating. It's absurd to think that somebody could come back and beat cancer and beat death and not only make it back on the bike, but to get to the very top of the sport when so many people were cheating. Of course. What were you thinking? Why didn't you know that? Easy to say now, but at that time, there was no proof. There was no proof. He was not failing tests. And when he did, the sport was covering for him by saying the cortisone in his sample was because of a cream that he used for saddle sores. So they made that go away. So it would have been irresponsible for me or anybody else without the facts or the benefit of a test to call him a cheater and not have the proof. We didn't know because he wasn't failing tests. So you can't come right out and scream, cheater, cheater, this guy's a cheater. So that said, I'm not exactly sure what the documentary is trying to say. And there isn't another half. That was just the first part. I'm not sure what they're trying to say or why it exists. But if it's an image rehab attempt, it's not working. If it's an exploration of tricky issues, that's really not working either. If it's a conversation about his legacy and whether the lying, cheating, bullying, deception, and total fraud erases the good that he did, and this is a really good question, right? All the good that he did, all the money that he raised, all the hope that he gave people, is that erased by the lie? You know, that's up for you to answer, but it hasn't really addressed that yet either. So, as I go to break, he has raised millions for cancer research. He has inspired millions. That is true. But again, what made that story so inspirational was the thought that he was doing it on the bike and that he was doing it clean. And he wasn't. And if you accused him of otherwise, he went at you hard. Bob Costas. Bob, it is so good to have you back. Let me start off by asking, Bob, how are you and everybody around you doing during this very unusual time?
We're fortunate to say, Romy, that we're all fine. We're healthy. We're well situated. Just waiting it out like everybody else and doing what we can. You're able to be on the air all the time. And even though, as you may know, I'm a notorious technophobe, I figured out the Zoom and the Skype and everything else, so I'm able to be on MLBN or anybody else that asks me. I shouldn't put it that way. Everybody will start asking me. Those who ask me, and it seems worthwhile to do, I'm able to do it.
I knew you would figure that stuff out, Bob. Bob Costas is joining us. I did not have a concern about that for even a moment. Listen, Bob, you've been around sports for decades. What then, even with this technology, what's it been like for you to be without sports for the last couple of months?
I think the fact that I have been around it for decades, Romy, makes it easier for me to deal with it, if that's the right way to put it. Do I hope for sports to be able to return safely and sensibly soon? Of course I do. But I'm not out on a ledge with nothing else to do. Actually, if you look at it the right way, this is an opportunity to do some things you otherwise might not have done. All those books on the shelf that you've been meaning to read, well, I've gotten to a lot of them. The old movies that you never saw or the ones you'd like to see again, this is the opportunity to do it. You know, to exercise more regularly than you do when you're busy, to eat a little more healthy. I was talking to Joe Maddon yesterday. Joe has gone from 208 pounds down to 193 because he's not eating out as much as he used to. I mean, Joe is a real foodie, and he loves his wine. But the upside of this situation, for him at least, is that he's gotten into much better shape. And he's been able, as he put it, to think about some things, including about the composition of his Angels roster and how he will approach this set of circumstances when they play, if they're able to, when they play half a season. He's always been a guy who is a thinker, but now I guess he's been able to double down on that. So, look, you and I and many of the people that we regularly associate with are very, very fortunate. We've just had to adjust. You really feel for the people who are trying to survive. So whatever adjustments we've had to make, we've made them, and we're lucky to be able to say so.
Extremely well said, Bob. Bob Costas is joining us. You know, Bob, I could and should follow you and talk baseball right there, and if we have time, I'll double back to it. But I do want to ask you, you were interviewed as part of The Last Dance. What's it like looking back on that time for you?
Well, it was a wonderful time, not just for the Bulls and Michael Jordan. It was a tremendous era in the NBA, which is not to say that the recent Golden State Warriors or the Cavaliers when they had LeBron or everything that Popovich and the Spurs accomplished wasn't great, but there was something about that era where Bird and Magic fed into Michael Jordan's run, and you have to give Isaiah and the Pistons a nod for what they did in between. Kareem was just retiring toward the end of the 80s. The Lakers and Celtics had that wonderful rivalry. You got the Dream Team thrown in. And I've said this in other places, and people can factor in my bias. I really think it mattered in terms of making Michael Jordan and the Bulls, but also the NBA itself, part of the pop culture conversation in a way that maybe it isn't now. It mattered that the biggest games were on NBC, on an over-the-air broadcast network, before the media landscape became as crowded as it is now. Those games, those big games, were on NBC, and the promos were on Seinfeld and ER and Friends and David Letterman and the Today Show, and that made it part of the pop culture conversation. There was a second Dream Team. It didn't have the impact of the first, but a second Dream Team in 96 at the Atlanta Olympics. So, look, it's nothing against the presentation of the games now. Ernie Johnson's show with Barkley, Shaq, and Kenny Smith is probably the best studio show in the history of American sports TV. It isn't about the quality. Mike Breen is a wonderful Hall of Fame announcer. But the NBA on NBC had a kind of prominence and a kind of resonance. We would show double and triple headers on a Saturday and Sunday on a weekend. There were playoff games, not just finals games, playoff games in prime time on weeknights. That meant that just about everybody who cared about it was in on it. And that game six, the Last Dance final game, is still by far the highest rated game in NBA history. And even though the way it ended, you couldn't ask for a more dramatic scenario, just think for a moment if there had been a game seven, and they came very close to having a game seven. A game seven on a Wednesday night on NBC in 1998, a larger rating still.
Bob Costas joining us. All right, Bob, so what about that? Game 6 of the 98 Finals has the highest TV ratings in NBA history. As popular as Kobe and LeBron have been, they have not broken that number. So in your mind, is it still possible to have an athlete and a team transcend sports the way Jordan and those Bulls did? Will we ever see anything like that again?
First of all, you have to have someone that great, that appealing. He's as handsome as a movie star. He was beautiful to watch. You have to have the constellation of stars around him. You know, it was a perfect storm. I just told you about the television component, the dream team component, the rivalries that were part of it. I don't want to call them secondary, but I guess I just did. But when you think of the other players who were gigantic stars, just think of the roster of the dream team, apart from Jordan and Pippen, who were the two Bulls on the team. It all just comes together. If you were casting a movie, and I guess The Last Dance in a way was a movie, if you were casting a movie, I don't know how you could possibly do better. Even on the Bulls, apart from Jordan himself, Pippen's a fascinating guy. So is Rodman. Jackson, obviously, is a very interesting guy. Steve Kerr, one of the most thoughtful and well-spoken athletes and role players, like Steve Kerr and John Paxson are part of the story. It's a rich story. It's not just some two-dimensional story. It's got a lot of texture to it.
Bob, what did you make of the image of Michael Jordan as a person that we saw depicted in that series?
Well, I think it humanized him a bit. I didn't like the way he picked on Jerry Krause. Look, there's legitimate criticism of Jerry Krause. I think it was Phil Jackson who said he deserved more credit than he got, but he wanted more credit than he deserved. And it was just insane to say, look, if you go 82-0, this is still your last year. And that ridiculous conceit, organizations win championships, not players. Well, of course, the whole organization matters. But without the key players, it doesn't matter what kind of genius you fancy yourself to be, you're not going to win. So, okay, Krause may have deserved some criticism, but that kind of cool kids versus the awkward kids thing that played out and you heard some of it, I didn't think that reflected well on Michael. But none of us are perfect. And I thought a lot of what came out, his passion, his commitment to it, his obvious thoughtfulness in, and what I mean by that is not kindness, I mean the thoughtful way in which he answered the questions. This is not a one or two dimensional person, and I think that came out. The influence of his father, his fondness for his mom, I think it added some texture to his story and increased people's appreciation of him, especially as a player. If they'd either forgotten or they were too young to have experienced it firsthand, their appreciation of him as a player, but also I think it filled him out a little bit, not fully, but it filled him out a little bit as a person.
Bob Costas joining us for a few more moments. Bob, it was not my intention to bring you on to talk exclusively about Michael Jordan, but you know baseball as well as anybody knows baseball, so I am curious about this. What do you make of Jordan's baseball career?
I think it's possible that had he committed to baseball, A, he wouldn't have been nearly as good a baseball player as he was a basketball player, and the country would have been deprived of one of its epic sports stories. But it's possible that he could have made the major leagues if he'd committed to baseball at the outset, you know, after he got out of high school. I know that Terry Francona and others in The Last Dance said that if he had stuck with Birmingham and made his way through the minor leagues, that he might have been able to make it to the majors. I think that's more they're expressing their respect for his work ethic. And it is kind of amazing that a guy that never played professional baseball and hadn't played baseball at all in a very long time was able to hit over 200 in the minor leagues. And he was a good base runner. He had a good arm in right field. The fact that he wasn't a joke, the focus on him made some people mock his baseball efforts. But the idea that somebody in their 30s could just leave their primary sport, try another, and not be terrible at it is kind of amazing, even at the double-A level. Do I think he would have made the major leagues had he stayed, had he not come back to the Bulls? No, I doubt it. But I think it was amazing that he was as good as he was.
We're talking to Bob Costas. So, Bob, in terms of the baseball season starting up, there's a number of things that are being discussed, obviously, right now. But should this happen, what would it be like to have a baseball season without fans, both for you as a fan and as a broadcaster?
Well, from the broadcasting standpoint, whether it's done from an essentially empty stadium or whether it's done in a studio, it isn't just the absence of the crowd in big moments, the cheering, the booing. There's a hum, a little buzz, a murmur of sound throughout a baseball game. And, of course, a baseball game is different from a basketball, hockey, or football game in terms of how it plays out and the way the crowd sort of fills in some of the spaces. And as a broadcaster, we'd have to be mindful of that. 4 or 5 seconds where the announcer doesn't say anything, and you have the pictures, but also you have the crowd sound, that sounds the way it should. 4 or 5 seconds without anyone saying anything and no crowd sound at all might seem strange. And we don't have any blueprint for this, so we're going to have to feel it as we go. I really don't know what to make of it, but we'll figure it out, I guess.
And then finally, one of the models that has been discussed has been expanding the roster, making the DH available in both leagues. Do you think there might be an opportunity for baseball to experiment and push the envelope a little bit this year in terms of tweaks to the game and how it's played? Might we see that, and might there be an opportunity there?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Romy. I think that now is the time. Even if some of the things that have been floated out there are things that I don't agree with, now is the time to try virtually everything other than running the bases backwards. Expand the playoffs, have a different playoff format. If they wanted to put in a pitch clock with nobody on base, the Players Association opposes it, so they probably won't be able to pull it off. But I think this would have been a good time to experiment with that. I think it makes absolute sense to have the DH in both leagues, even though some of us favor the strategy that having the pitcher bat brings to the National League. They're going to be very concerned about injuries. They already were concerned in a normal season about injuries to American League pitchers who ordinarily don't bat, ordinarily don't run the bases. There's no point in taking any risk in that situation. I don't think you're going to see rosters once we return to normal and they're playing regular seasons. I don't think you're going to see rosters expanded to the extent that we'll see now. But it makes sense now because you just kind of need that sort of taxi squad in these unusual circumstances. But whatever they want to experiment with, if they want to experiment with putting a guy on second base and extra innings to move things along, I think that's a horrible idea. But now's the time to try it and then, you know, throw everything against the wall and see what sticks.
He is an MLB Network host, a play-by-play announcer, the recipient of 28 Emmy Awards, the recipient of the Ford C. Frick Award for Major Contributions to Baseball. He has also hosted 11 Olympic Games in prime time. Bob, I know there are obviously much more pressing matters, but I would be lying if I said that I was not looking forward to our first Javier's run, which I don't know if you had thought about, but I had already scheduled for earlier this year. So maybe we can rain check that. I was certainly looking forward to that.
You know, we are not that far apart, but we might as well be a world apart with social distancing. We could hop in our respective cars right now and meet at Javier's or Mastro's or Moto Mio, but there wouldn't be anybody there. Well, there might be for takeout, but it wouldn't be what you have in mind.
Yeah, Bob, I agree with you. I don't know about you, but I was driving around this weekend down by the beach communities, and there certainly were people in restaurants, and some were social distancing, and some were not. There were people at the beach. Some were social distancing, and some were not. So leave us with this thought. Are you still staying indoors? Are you getting out? How are you approaching it at this point?
Well, luckily, we spend some time, as you know, that's what you were alluding to. We spend some time between the first of the year and the start of the baseball season, ordinarily, in California. And so we happened to be here when COVID-19 reached critical mass, so we didn't have to think about where we'd be. This is the best place to be, both because of the weather and because we are, to answer your question, able to get out. So we take long walks around the neighborhood, hang around in the backyard. That's probably a healthier situation than being in an apartment in New York, all things considered. But other than people we see on the walks, and instinctively, whether we know them or not, they veer one way and we veer another. It's just kind of understood by everybody, and then you wave at them from a distance. Apart from that, I haven't seen too many people in person over the last 2.5 months.
Exactly how we've done it. Exactly the same way. Bob Costas, my guest. Bob, I appreciate you so much. Great to have you on the show, and I always look forward to it. Thank you very much, Bob.
All right, Romy. Be well. See ya.
So coming off that long 4-day bender, that 4-day weekend, it is officially heat check time in the jungle. In fact, even before I can mention that, we got off to a good start in hour number one, right? All of you clones have been going pretty hard for the last couple of weeks, and I'm wondering where you are after a few days in the basement. In other words, did my mini staycation act as a cooler to all of you? Did it lull you into sleep? Or maybe did it ramp up the urgency? Because the fact is, the clock is spinning quickly. I'm hoping that's the case. A huge chunk of the Smack-Off clock burned off since I was last here on Thursday. So right now, we're just 24 days out. 24 days. Like, don't get kind of lulled in by that number that I reset every single day. That's only 24 days until Smack-Off 26. 24 days to get in the reps, lock in your RSVP, maybe ignite some old beefs, start some new ones. And if you're holding a golden ticket, to solidify that invite right now. Don't go nodding off right now. Do what you need to do to wake yourself up, shake it off, and get back into Smack-Off mode, because this thing is not waiting for anybody. Before I get into today's player profile, I want to talk to the watch listers. Not those who have a golden ticket, but those who are on the watch list. You're on the radar to maybe get a golden ticket. Jeff in SoCal, Johnny Scabs in the D, Jason, Harrisburg. This is it, fellas. Your time is running out. You don't even have a golden ticket that you may or may not get ripped. You're not even in that conversation yet. You should be on hold every single day until you either get what you want or until I tell you to jog on for good. Trust me, I want to give these things out. That's what they're here for. Come and get yours. Play your way in for the 19th. Now, speaking of the 19th and the main event, this player that I'm about to profile is the most experienced caller in the field, and it's not even close. Nobody comes close. 25 Smack-Offs have gone down on these airwaves, and this 1998 champion has been there for 20 of them. Of course, I'm talking about Stevie Carbone. Now, the word legend does get thrown around way too much, but I don't know what else you would call a dude with two decades of Smack-Off appearances to his name. A guy who was in the inaugural event back in 95. He was in the first one, and he was in the most recent one in 2019. It's a hell of an accomplishment. And the guy has not aged out. Not at all. He hasn't lost anything. Not at all. Because as recently as 2 years ago, Stevie Carbone damn near won the whole thing. At that time, Leffen Laguna was responsible for each of the holy bleep moments in 2016 and 2017. And then Carbone shows up in 2018 and he beat the bully at his own game with a cameo for the ages.
Let's stop it with the gimmicks. I mean, some people look at last year's gimmick as, wow, how cool. He rounded up the old geezers from yesteryear. They had a little powwow. What a nostalgic moment. I, on the other hand, looked at it as like, great. You brought in 63 people into the studio that had a combined one Smack-Off title between them. Filth, which might have been the worst call to ever win this thing. I'm old school. I've been around since the night show. I've been around long enough to remember when Hacksaw was piecing together fake interviews he claimed to do. And I still think to this day he thinks Napoleon Kaufman got his leg amputated. But the new school stuff, it's just, it's not fun for me anymore. I liked having rivals. I had one rival back in the day. That was the Calvin Asian. I loved kicking that guy in the nuts during my phone calls about his balding or his weight gain or his radio career. I mean, Jesus, that guy was so fun.
No, thank you, Steve. ABC's attorneys are online too. I got this. Jim, it's great to be back.
That was a holy bleep moment. That was Stevie Carbone teeing up the handoff to a five-time Smack-Off champ and a bitter rival, Shawnee the Cowboy Asian, who ran a minute of fire after getting that baton. It may or may not have won Stevie the Smack-Off, but it was arguably the defining moment of 2018. Not only did he resurrect his fiercest rival, who had the most titles at that time, but he brought back a dude that we had not heard from in 11 years. And that cameo opened up the door to the Cablin Asians' first solo run in over a decade, 1 year later at Smack-Off 25. So that was awesome. But don't get it twisted. Carbone and the Cowboy Nation do not like each other. They have a long history of giving each other the hands, trading haymakers. Carbone has landed more than his fair share of shots square on Shawnee's jaw.
I know the absence of the Calvin Asian in the Smack-Off has people talking. Should he be here? Should he not be here? Here's my question. Why does he want to be here? Shawnee, you've gravy-trained 5 titles to your own radio show, and now you're upset you can't make your one call a year where you save takes from the previous 364 days? I went to your station website the other day and saw a picture of you there. As Clark Griswold told Cousin Eddie, you're looking fit. Shawnee, let's just hope that your career rivals Jim's in the radio business and not JT the Shtick. I caught some of his show recently. I mean, wow. 1,000 calls a show is good radio? Really? I would have loved to hear your takes, if you had any. Do you even talk? Is it possible to be the host of a national radio show and not actually host their national radio show? I will say, though, the best part about the show is at least you're not insecure at all about being associated with the jungle. I mean, it's killing you that most people still see you as the first Smack-Off winner rather than a national talk show host. Totally can't tell by listening to your show.
Carbone. Carbone is a savage. Somewhere the brick's got to be like, the hell did I do? The hell did I do? That's Stevie Carbone, man. My guest is Chase Elliott. Chase, I want to get into the paint scheme in just a minute, but before we do that or anything else, how are you and everybody around you doing during this pandemic, Chase?
Yeah, doing all right. Appreciate you asking. Hope everybody's good on your end, and thanks for asking.
Now, you got it. They are. Thank you for asking as well, and it's good to have you back. So you're coming off this race on Sunday where you ran really well to the point where you had a nearly 2-second lead with 3 laps to go. Then the 24, Chase cuts a tire, and the caution flag comes out. What was going through your mind at that point?
Unfortunate. Thought we had a real good shot at it there prior to that caution coming out, when a caution comes out late in a race like that, ultimately you're just put in a position. It's kind of a lose-lose spot. People around you or people behind you are always going to do the opposite of whatever the leader does or the people in front of them to try to gain, try to get the lead. So, if you stay out in that situation, I'm sure a lot of people pit. If you pit, I'm sure a lot of people are going to stay out. But it just, it's a tough place to be in, and unfortunately it didn't work out.
Man, you knew I was going to go there next. Exactly right. So the decision was to pit with the belief that other cars would follow, hopefully, but they did not. Then on the restart, you had to battle your way back to third. Ultimately, you finished second. I know that that's how these things go, but that doesn't make it any less frustrating. How frustrating and challenging was that then?
Yeah, it was a tough one for sure. I mean, especially being the Coke 600 that's a big time race for us and in the NASCAR world. That means a lot, and to the people who have won that race, that is a pretty pretty elite group. And that's just one of those races that you'd love to end your career and say you won. So hopefully one day we'll have another shot at it.
Chase Elliott joining us. One more thought about that. That's coming on the heels of that race 4 nights earlier at Darlington where you had a shot to win and then Kyle Busch clipped you from behind. I don't know. I mean, Chase, you've been around this game your entire life. You know how these things go. It's a part of the sport. At the same time, as you look back the last 2 weeks, is there any part of you that wants to say, come on, can you give me a break here?
Yeah, the last 2 weeks have been really tough. I feel like we've put ourselves in really good positions as a team and good position. We've made good decisions and we've made good adjustments on the cars throughout these races. And those are things that you don't always get right. I think that's what's frustrating for me is it's a hard thing to make all the right moves and the right decisions and get the car driving exactly like you want it. And when you have those days and those type of runs and those type of cars, you want to make the most of it. And I think that's where the frustration is the worst for me is just knowing that stuff isn't forever. It's not something you get right all the time. And we've had 2 opportunities to get away. So I think that's the hard thing to swallow is just knowing that. But the silver lining in is we've been running well and that's encouraging. We just got to keep doing it. And it's still early in the season.
Chase Elliott's joining us. And I guess also it's good that you get to run back quickly, but then that doesn't give you much time. I mean, the whole thing is just so unusual, Chase, but How do you go about preparing to run it back again tomorrow night in Charlotte?
Yeah, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I've really enjoyed the race and the midweek racing. I've enjoyed the lack of practice. I've enjoyed the challenge that brings. And frankly, I think, you know, we've over time just migrated to these schedules that are just way too drawn out. And I think we're learning as a group, and I think NASCAR's learning as a sanctioning body that we don't have to practice for 2 days to lead up to an event. I think we can put on a great show, much like we're doing right now, and potentially do more of it. So I think I really think NASCAR has been in a unique situation to be able to make some changes with all this and learn. And I think we'll learn a lot right now as a group. So hopefully we can apply some of this stuff down the road.
We're talking to Chase Elliott, and we'll do so for a few more moments. In the meantime, you are running the truck race tonight, and there is a bounty on Kyle Busch. The bounty has been modified with $50,000 going to COVID-19 relief in the name of the driver who beats him. For those who don't know, how did that bounty first come to be, and how much are you looking forward to getting out there tonight?
Yeah, so the whole thing really was Kevin Harvick's idea, and it was kind of something he was messing around with on Twitter, and it gained a lot of traction and a lot of interest. Originally, I was supposed to run, you know, Atlanta the weekend that our season got shut down, and you know that obviously didn't work out. But you know, Kevin and I talked a little bit the other day, and you know, we just felt like the smart thing was to try to put that money towards something good if we were to go out there and beat Kyle and earn it. And I think that's the right thing. You know, this is a much larger deal going on than him handing out $50,000 to anybody who beats him. You know, I think we can do some good with it. And I think that's why it changed to what it is. And I'm supportive of it.
Chase, I'm really curious. Like, you and I have talked about this in the past, and I mentioned it earlier, but it's a part of your family, racing. It's a part of your life. Knowing that, what's it been like going the last couple of months without racing?
Yeah, it's been odd. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, I don't know that I've, you know, in the last, you know, I'm only 24, but heck, I've been, you know, racing a lot, you know, really for the past 10 or 11 years, and I don't know that I've had that many consecutive days at home or in one state in over 10 years. And like my dad, you know, talking to him about that, he's much the same, except it's more like 30 or 40 years worth, you know. So it's been different for sure. I try to cherish my time at home and enjoy that because it's something that we don't typically get. So you know, try to find the good in some of that stuff and make the most of it. But it's definitely odd for sure. Our off season isn't that long, and even through our off season we're still busy doing things. So it was a change of pace.
Chase Elliott joining us. I'm still shaking my head, and I always do when I remember that you are just 24. And I say that because I've always been so impressed with the way you approach your job, not just as a driver, but as a teammate, as a partner in business, and so much more. I mean, there's so much more to being a driver that people never, ever see. So how do you get the right balance off the track?
Yeah, you know, you just try to, you know, put things that are what's important to you in the right order, you know, and I think the number one thing is just realizing, especially in the NASCAR world, with as many partners and people that we deal with and talk to every day, you're never going to make everybody happy. So you just need to go ahead and understand that going into it, that somebody's always going to be mad, somebody's not going to get their way, and you just can't let that affect you know, your job or your performance on track. So I think that's the biggest thing, is just understanding that and just trying to do the best you can to find balance for everybody, but also accept that it's not always going to be perfect for everyone involved.
Chase Elliott, my guest. All right, so you're working with Kelley Blue Book and the new paint scheme. Can you lay that out for us? How did that come to be?
Yeah, Kelley Blue Book has been a partner of mine ever since I got to Cup. So we've been working together for a number of years now, and they always do a new paint scheme every year. So this is their first race of the season, so I get to unveil it tomorrow night. And car looks good, always has it. They typically have really good looking cars, so looking forward to getting their colors on track.
It's another big week. He is the driver of the number 9 car for Hendrick Motorsports, entering his fifth full-time Cup Series season and already a 2-time most popular driver. Chase, appreciate you very much. Great to have you back. Good luck this week and always good to talk to you.
You bet. Yeah, thanks. Have a good day.
Good night now!